Chapter 10. Fine weather was running to waste, and I had seen nothing of Utah outside the city, so on the afternoon of September the 25th, I threw a few pounds of crackers, dried beef, sugar, and tea into my valise to serve in case I should get beyond the settlements, and took my way northward on foot, determined to see Mormondom in its rural aspects. The nearest point on the Great Salt Lake is about 12 miles from the city, and this road nowhere approaches it nearer than 2 miles, but runs due north, with the Wasatch Mountains to the east and the lake to the west, leaving a valley with an average width of 5 miles. My route led me by the Warm Springs already mentioned. 3 miles farther there is another known as the Hot Springs, from being 26 degrees higher in temperature than the former. A stream of scalding water as large as a man's body boils out of a rock at the foot of the mountain, forms a hot pool 2 or 3 rods in circuit, whence the branch runs across the road and westward into Hot Spring Lake. These springs will be more fully described in another place. The sun was near the horizon when I reached the highest point on the road. The sky, which had been hazy all day, became clear, and glancing back towards the city, I saw her light-colored dwellings and green gardens glistening in the evening sunlight, reminding one strangely of pictures of Oriental scenes. While the gray peaks to the east, the blue mountains to the southwest, and the Lake Island hills combined to form a grand circle of beauty surrounding the modern Zion. Seated on a projecting rock above the road as the sun sank slowly behind the islands, I tried again and again to convey some description of the scene to paper, and as often dropped book and pencil with a mixture of delight and despair. 10 miles out brought me to Sessions Settlement, sometimes called Bountiful, where I spent the night at the house of Mr. Perry Green Sessions, a Mormon elder and returned missionary who entertained me with some account of his experience in England and the Eastern States while laboring to build up Zion among those that are in darkness. From there, I continued my journey along the stage road, now along the base of the mountains, where cold springs break in jets out of the rocks, and again far out in the valley among corn and cane fields, or amid dwellings surrounded by peach orchards, where the trees were breaking under the load of ripening fruit, a sight I had not seen for many years. A larger and finer orchard than ordinary attracted my attention, and as the gate stood invitingly open, I walked forward to where 2 women sat beneath a tree preparing fruit for drying, and proposed to purchase 12 or 2 of peaches. Fruit in plenty was offered and all pay refused, and while I took a proffered seat, the younger lady, a bright, lively, voluble woman, entered at once into conversation by asking what state I had come from. "How do you know I am not a Utah man?" I asked. "Oh, I knowed you as a Gentile the minute you stepped in at the gate, and you bet everybody knows it the minute they see you," was the reply. Further conversation showed that the lady had quite a history. She told me her father came to Salt Lake City 21 years ago, and she was the 3rd white child born in the place. But I couldn't see it in my way to marry a saint, not much, though I was raised to believe in it, and do believe in the religion all but that. "Is your father a Mormon?" I ventured to ask. "Oh, yes, and got 4 women. Only 1 wife, mind you, that's my mother, but 4 women who call themselves his wives. I never was raised to know anything else, but when I was 19, father married me to a Gentile, 'cause he couldn't help himself, I reckon. My husband was raised next door to me, and went to California and stayed 5 years, and soon as he come back, we was married. I'd have stayed an old maid 1,000 years before I'd take a pluralist. Plurality's all well enough for the men, but common sense shows that it don't suit women." "Why, then, do some of them hold up for it?" "Well, they think they must to get salvation. It's a part of their religion, and sometimes they get along pretty well. We never had any trouble in father's family. The children all growed up just like brothers and sisters and treated each other so. Father always taught me to respect his other women, and I always did so. But law, I've seen such sights in other families. Why, I've seen our neighbors' women just pull the hair right out of each other's heads. There's so many men, when they get a young wife, will let her abuse the old one and encourage her to do it. I've seen the man stand by and say, 'Go in, kill her, if you can.' Now, there is Ify, Roberts, right over there," pointing to a stone house near the mountain. he brought a real young, delicate wife from New York, now going on 16 years ago, and she worked awful hard, I tell you. Why? I've known her to do all her own work when Effie had three hands and the threshing machine at his house, and sometimes she worked out in the field, bound wheat and raked hay, which, you know, is awful hard on a delicate New York woman. Tain't as if she'd been raised to it like we folks. And after all, just last year Effie went and married another woman, a real young one, not over 20, and don't you think this spring she knocked Maria, that's his first wife, down with the churn dasher and scalded her. Aoife stood by and just said, go and loose kill her if you can. It all started about a churn, too. Both wanted to use it at once. Maria had it, and her butter was a little slow a-coming, and they got mad, and Luce struck her, and then snatched the kettle right off the stove, and then poured hot water on her feet, so she fell down when she tried to run out. And what was the result, finally? Well, Maria left him. Of course she had to, or be killed. It's very nice, though, for the men. I had a dozen chances to marry old Mormons, but law, I wouldn't give that for all of them. Why, just turn things round and let a woman have two or three men and see how they'd like that. There wouldn't be no murdering done in these parts. Oh, no. And I reckon a woman has as fine feelings as a man. I tell you, if my husband ever joins them or tries to get another wife, that day I'll hunt another Gentile. You bet. The testimony of this witness, professionally speaking, was certainly plain, nor did she trouble me to cross-examine, but gave her views freely. I note one singular fact in all similar cases. During a long residence in Utah, I have never in a single instance talked 10 minutes with a young lady of polygamous family that did not manage in some way to tell me she was the daughter of the first or legal wife, if such was the case. If silent on that point, it may safely be presumed they are of polygamous mothers, and in more than one instance I have known them to falsely claim legitimate birth. From this apostates, I journeyed on to Farmington, 18 miles north of the city, a beautiful town and settlement of some 2,000 inhabitants. The residence of the Mormon hero Lot Smith, who commanded their guerrilla force at the time it confronted Johnson's army in Echo Canyon, burned his wagons and drove off his cattle. I spent the night with a well-to-do Mormon who occupied a long, one-story stone house, divided into three large rooms, with a kitchen in the rear of each. Each room was occupied by one of his three wives and her children. He seemed to be living at the time with the middle one, where we took supper. The partition walls must have been 2 feet thick, without any communication, each wife with her progeny keeping strictly to her own department. He was doubtless a Grant man. His motto seemed to be, "Let us have peace." A constitutional, the next morning, brought me to the next settlement, Kaysville by name, where I took breakfast with a Gentile who had a Mormon wife. He was a Missourian some 50 years old and belonged to the church, he told me, 10 or 15 years ago, but was disfellowshipped for not paying tithes. He talked quite earnestly when he found I was from the States and gave his views on the entire subject without troubling me to ask a question. "I never heard in my life," said he, "that Christ and his apostles rode around the country in a fine carriage with two span o' gray hosses and made the people turn out provision enough to keep him up, as we've had to do for the bishop here. Brigham Young pretends to be his successor and at the same time makes his brags that he never touches anything. He don't make money. Outen." Now, just look at that Deseret Telegraph line. He had all the people pay tithes and make donations for it, saying it would be such a nice thing, people, and every settlement had to furnish a certain number of polls, and now they'll charge you $5 for sending 10 words, be you saint or Gentile. And here, after all, he's round making every saint, the poorest of them, give so much to help pay these operators that come down to teach the girls along through the territory how to work the wires. Now, what comes of that money? It goes into Brigham's pockets. But pshaw, these people won't listen to you. Can't make my wife believe a word o' that. The good woman retorted with a wordy defense of the church and the prophet, averring her firm belief in everything Mormon, to which the husband listened with a dry, quizzical smile, and finally remarked, "Well, perhaps I had better go back. Guess I will, and get me another wife. Like darnation well to have a nice, trim, young creature about 25. The wife, whose waist was after the pattern of a rum barrel, and her feet models for a patent brick machine, reddened a little and was silent. I think he will convert her yet. The Deseret telegraph line to which he referred follows this road to the northern boundary of the territory, and south of the city extends nearly to Arizona, with side branches connecting all the detached settlements. The wires center in Brigham Young's office, and thus at a moment's notice, he can send a warning of danger to 5/6 of his people. And in 24 hours' time, the most isolated settlers could be ready to move. Whether for good or bad purposes, it is a remarkable monument of Mormon enterprise. I had intended to keep the Sabbath at this point, but falling in with a farmer returning to Cache Valley from the city, I rode some 12 miles with him, passing over the Red Sand Desert. This is a ridged piece of land jutting out from near the mouth of Weber Canyon towards the lake, about 10 miles long and 8 wide, and too high for ordinary irrigation. Most of the land north of the city has one general character, a mixture of gravel and loam, or of fine red sand and doby earth, a peculiar whitish clay. In its natural state, it is as barren as any part of the plains. A piece of land is worthless unless water can be brought upon it, but with irrigation, it produces equally with any soil in the world. Leaving the ridge, we descend into Weber Valley, and in 5 miles reach the city of Ogden, the most important in northern Utah, containing with its vicinity a population of 3,000 or 4,000, and now the point of junction of the Union Pacific, Central Pacific, and Utah Central Brigham's railroads. Thence, 2 days sauntering, 22 miles, brings me through Willard Settlement to Brigham City, some 60 miles north of Salt Lake City. This is the county seat of Box Elder County, which contains at present a Gentile population of at least 1,000. It has a beautiful location at the foot of the Wasatch, at the mouth of a canyon, which sends out a large stream of pure, clear water, and a little northeast of the head of Bear River Bay, the northeastern projection of Great Salt Lake. From Brigham City northward, the Valley of Salt Lake shows much less sign of cultivation and settlement than below that point. Peach orchards entirely disappear. Apple trees and grapevines are quite rare. Stone houses and stucco-finished dobies are seen no more, and their place is filled by rude log cabins, with a very uninviting exterior and interior not over clean, inhabited mostly by Welsh, Danes, and Swedes. The English inhabitants of the valley live quite well, nearly as well as the corresponding class in our western states, though I have visited no part of America where I found them so entirely English in dialect and manner as here. Taking my meals wherever the hour overtook me, I have found rich brown coffee, golden butter, and light white bread, in company with the broad English accent, and have learned to associate the hexasperated H with IOPS for an ungree man. But if I stepped into a cabin and heard the Welsh or Danish guttural, I asked some trivial favor and passed on to the Britons, whom I consider the best part of the Mormon people. A traveler should not be an epicure, but I acknowledge a weakness in that respect, and while I had that glorious appetite, I hated to waste it on the suspicious-looking porridge, which is as a standing dish among the Scandinavian saints. A few of the American Mormons come up to the English standard, but in the country the majority fall below it. They constitute, however, so small a part of these people that I do not stop with them one time in 5. They are nearly all from New York and Pennsylvania, and belong to the original sect, all the late converts being foreigners. I see no Western people among them to speak of. I met one middle-aged lady from Greene County, Indiana, and when she learned I was from Park County, adjoining, she was quite overcome, got me up the best breakfast the cabin afforded, and talked and cried alternately while I was eating it. Her parents joined the Mormons while she was a young woman, and she has heard from her old home but 3 or 4 times since. That region was attracting considerable interest as the probable site of the great central city of the future, the town on the railroad, which was to be the most convenient spot for staging and freighting to Montana, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington, which would doubtless be a city of great and permanent importance. But the railroad was yet 400 miles distant, and the location of the future city in great doubt. Many thought it would be at the last crossing on Weber River, while others were equally sanguine it would be in Curlew Valley, 100 miles west of Bear River. Meanwhile, work was pushed forward rapidly. The Union Pacific Company had just let contracts for 100 miles of grading north of the lake. Teams were passing that way in considerable numbers, and graders' camps were thick along the route. At the north crossing of Bear River, I found a home station of Wells Fargo & Company's stages, where their branch line to Boise City and into Oregon takes its start. Also a fine hotel, bridge, store, and quite a little village. A few miles above, Bear River, which has run around a long U of 300 miles from its source in eastern Utah, canyons downward 1,000 feet in 3 miles out of Cache into Bear River Valley. 70 miles up the river in Idaho are the noted Soda Springs. Near them, Camp Connor and a small settlement of Morrisites, a sect of recusant Mormons, a little more crazy than the rest, but not quite so mean, who sought the shelter of the military in their escape from Brighamism. My return trip from Bear River was varied by two incidents worthy of special mention: a visit to the mineral springs and an interview with the mad philosopher of Utah. This eccentric genius merits more than a passing notice. His name is J.W. Barker, generally called Professor, an Englishman by birth, who came to this country 14 years ago with a Mormon party. He claimed to have discovered the primitive laws which govern the whole material universe, and that, in time, he would refute all the theories of such philosophers as Newton, Laplace, and Descartes, from whom he dissented in toto. True to his convictions, as soon as he had his family comfortably settled, he fell to work investigating, collecting facts, analyzing and arranging specimens, and writing the principia of his great work, the Magna Charta of Universal Science, which was to annihilate all our present ideas of gravity, light, and momentum, and usher in the scientific millennium, at the same time with the moral regeneration of mankind. For 10 long, weary years, he has devoted every hour beyond those requisite for obtaining the bare necessaries of life to this research. He has traveled hundreds of miles among the mines and canyons, digging into drift, wash dirt, gravel, quartz, and gold, gulch, and bar, till he is known to the miners from Montana to Salt Lake. Night after night, he has watched the moon and stars and calculated the slightest changes of the atmosphere and mist, and every observation has been faithfully recorded and assigned to its proper cause in his new classification of principles. Being an unlettered man, whose only knowledge of geology was gained as an English miner, he has worked his way against difficulties which would have daunted any but a half-mad enthusiast, has surrounded himself with dictionaries and lexicons of science, and hammered his way into the first principles of more than one language by the most exhaustive labor. I found the professor in a mountain nook which might well excuse a man for going mad over the works of nature. Directly fronting his house, three majestic gray peaks of the Wasatch Range rise a mile above the level plain, while a short distance in the rear of his farm spread the azure waters of the Salt Lake, beyond which is the blue line of the mountains on the promontory. His painfully thin and gaunt appearance showed that he had hung over his books and burned the midnight oil till the vital frame had shrunk, but his manner was earnest and his voice firm, while the corded muscles stood out on a body without an ounce of fat and seemed to run over the bones like the wire pulleys of a metal clock. He conversed pleasantly and quite intelligently on various topics, till glancing at the mountain peaks, I remarked that they must have been thrown up by some great convulsion of nature. Then his eyes lighted with a strange fire as he hastily replied, "They certainly were not thrown up. They were thrown down." Then, holding forth an hour on the origin of mountains, he invited me to his study. A low room half underground in the rear of his house, built of logs, had been rudely fitted up with board, chest, and table, block candle holders attached to the wall by wires so as to bend out and in, and a few chairs. The walls were completely covered with rude maps and charts, and with long lists of words, which he stated he had to use often and did not know how to spell, all copied from the dictionary in large capitals. Producing a seat for me and a large bowl of water for himself, he entered on a 3 hours exposition of his views. He holds that all the fluid elements of nature are resolvable into four gases, that all the grosser elements are in like manner reducible to four simple solids, and from varying proportions of these few primitives are derived all possible materials throughout the universe. He contends also that the entire Newtonian theory of gravity is erroneous and false to true science, that there is, in strictness of language, no such principle as gravity anywhere operating in creation, that the terms refraction and reflection are based on a total misconception of the nature of light, that all space outside of the atmosphere contains a material medium, and that the atmosphere is shown by actual demonstration to be 8,000 miles thick instead of 45. He thinks that all nature is operated upon by four simple, constant, and regular laws, and that all we observe are but combinations and interrelations of these four, which depend for their action simply on the will and moving power of God. They operate in one course through countless cycles of time, tending always to a common center, and having run that course, are directed in a returning course for other terms. The mental, moral, and spiritual world is but a microcosmical copy of the material, consisting of four subtle elements mingled with four grosser elements, and moved upon by infinite combinations of four simple laws, directly referable to the will of God. The mountains are remains of precipitated satellites, of which the earth has had many, the moon only remaining. But like all the others, it is a hollow globe, destined to fall upon and give final shape to the surface of the earth. The planets inside of our orbit have now no satellites, but are hurrying on to their destiny on the face of the sun, while those outside of us have many, and are coming in more slowly. We on the earth are approaching the latter part of our career, and have barely time to complete the moral regeneration of the race. It is consoling to know that the grand smash-up will not take place till after the millennium. The old gentleman has just finished his great work, and required all the information I could give him as to the cost and facilities of getting it printed in the East. It consisted of 46 chapters, bound up in as many separate manuscript volumes. Take him all in all, he is a curious case of scientific insanity, well worthy the attention of Mr. Beck, the learned writer on the subject. The professor lectures in Salt Lake City occasionally, and Orson Pratt, professor and elder and the learned man of the city, has thought it worthwhile to reply to him through the press. Wild and strange as this man's ideas may appear, he is but a type of hundreds in Utah. In science as in theology, Mormonism is at war with all existing systems. One-third of the whole people seem a little crazy on some subject or other, and the wildest, most baseless theory, the one farthest removed from natural causes, is ever the one most likely to prevail. Having cut loose from all recognized standards in spiritual matters, they seem equally determined on the supernatural and extra-human in medicine, science, astronomy, and natural history. I was once called upon by a Mormon, a little more crazy than ordinary, with an immense chart of what he called celestial masonry. For the medical museum of a madhouse, it would have been a priceless treasure. A canvas 3 feet square was covered by the pictured folds of an enormous serpent, along which were drawings of the various scenes, symbols, and implements of the new masonry, divided for the various degrees, of which there are 27. All the work had been done with colored crayons, by inspirational writing, as the Mormon averred, the spirits guiding his hand without his volition, and as a work of art it showed remarkable style and finish. Some 3 years ago, a Josephite, or recusant Mormon, who had adopted the new Mormon doctrine of transmission of spirits, conceived that he was Adam sent back to the flesh. His wife, a little worse crazed, was Eve, but during the 6,000 years of their separation, she had fallen away and become a prostitute. To purify her, he cut off all her hair, pulled out her teeth, and for the better convenience of locomotion, dressed her in man's clothes, when both started on foot for the States. A year afterwards, they made their appearance at a ranch in Colorado, nearly dead with hunger and fatigue. Nor did it ever appear how they had reached there. From there, they came with a returning train to the Missouri, where the authorities properly consigned them to the lunatic asylum. There is no refuge for the insane in Utah, fortunately, perhaps, for it might require a small war to settle who should occupy it. Few are violent, but many are deranged, and the whole territory would present a fine field for the student in the jurisprudence of insanity. The mineral springs are 10 miles south of Bear River Bridge and 70 north of the city, but I defer a full description which will be found under the proper heading. In my trip to Bear River and return, I journeyed nearly 200 miles among the rural saints and observed their ways with all earnestness and curiosity. The country Mormon is more religious than his city brother, but less intelligent. He is a greater stickler for the small matters of his faith, but much less able to give a reason why. He is more hospitable, generous, and social, but much more offensive in thrusting the unpleasant features of his faith upon you. But the greatest difference is among the women. The polygamous wife in the city is in paradise compared with her sister in the country, where farm labors and cares must be shared in common. There, the condition of woman is already fast tending to what it is in other polygamous countries, and there the degeneracy is soonest manifest. While the men are enthusiastically devoted to their faith, I did not see a single woman in the country who defended polygamy, though strongly Mormon in everything else. At least one-third the entire population of the valley is from Great Britain, one-third or more from Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, while possibly one-sixth is American. As far as I know, all the posts of honor, indeed all the easy and lucrative positions, are filled by Americans, simply because the others are generally incapable. The missionaries are largely of foreign birth, each being sent back to his native country after a few years' residence in Utah. Little more than a year afterwards, in visiting the same section, I met with an experience in Brigham City, which, though equally novel, was nothing like so pleasant. The saints, who had seemed indifferent on my first visit, were altogether too pointed in their attentions the last time. But I anticipate. I reached Salt Lake City the morning of October the 6th, in time for the fall conference of 1868.